So anyway, I know most of you, and good to see you, and good to be here. And I got a title for my sermon. I titled it, If I Were the Devil. If I Were the Devil. Now, obviously I'm not, but that wasn't supposed to be humorous, but I guess, some of you know me better than I thought you did. But if I were the devil, I would be an expert in overthrowing people. And certainly, well, don't forget, you know, ancient Israel, how many times did Satan just basically overthrow Israel in a number of ways or hurt it a lot? If I was the devil, I've conquered people like Ananias, Sapphira. I mean, I could go through, you know, many people in the Bible that were true Christians once. Paul talks about this Alexander the coppersmith. We don't really know a whole lot about him. One is Hymenaeus, he mentions, and you could see that name. Demas was a minister and elder who was pretty influential, and one of Paul mentions in one of the letters, and later he talks about he left the church. So the Bible is a book of history. And that's what I want to take a look at today, because the devil is always consistent in the way he operates. He never deviates from the way he operates. And I find it fascinating because history is sort of a thing of things going on and on and on, various things. You see the same thing just repeated over and over in various ways. But let's turn, it's just two scriptures I want to look at before I go into a book of the Bible. Over in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 is the first one that I will mention. 1 Corinthians chapter 10. And when Mr. Petty called and said that he was going to be here, he said I still had to speak, so I guess that took care of that. I was feeling pretty good there for a moment. But 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Now, Paul is relating to a number of Old Testament examples of things that have happened in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. And he talks about, I'll read verse 1 here for just a few verses here. He says, Moreover, brethren, I don't want you to be unaware that our fathers were under the cloud and all passed through the sea. And he talks about they drank the same spiritual rock, which was Jesus Christ, which is one of the proofs that Jesus Christ was in the Old Testament quite a bit. Verse 6, all these things happen because, you know, I could say I wanted water, but there'd be so many people come running up here with a water bottle. I don't really need it. If you're going to give it to me, I'll take it. I really didn't even want it. Would you come back and get it again? It was just my attempt at, you know, getting a little inspiration here before the blackout hits. So all these things happened for examples. All these things that we read about in the Old Testament, that we should not lust after evil things as they lusted. Now, verse 11, I'll just read this. All these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition on whom the ends of the ages have come. So we see all these things that happen in the Bible, and they're trying to point us to make us to see things, to see situations. Now, over in Romans 15, just one other verse, and then I wanted to turn to a book of the Bible for a few minutes that I think is quite illustrative for us. Romans 15, verse 4. Paul again mentions this about examples for us, but Romans, well, it's so cold I can't even turn the pages. They're sticking together here. And it was also cold in Athens, too. They're having rolling blackouts in Athens also, and we didn't actually have one in our house. So we'll probably get home and probably we'll have, anyway, I'm being very, very sad, somber, am I not, about my house? But we'll deal with it when we deal with the snake that's going to fall out of the ceiling here in a little while. Romans 15, verse 4, whatever things were written, they were written for our learning, for Christians learning, that we through patience and comfort of the scriptures might have hope. So God wants us to know these things. Now the devil, he knows history. And he knows all the things that's happened. He knows the lessons better than we do. But yet he's the devil. Do you remember ancient Israel? How they were overthrown time and time again in the time of the judges? I want to turn to the book of Judges for a little while. Because I'm sure you know this, but I would encourage you to read this entire book of Judges sometime soon, because it's so illustrative of what is going on in the world today, in the church today, in our society, in our, you know, whether it's the United States or whether it's the world. We live in a very disturbing time. Now in Judges chapter 3, I want to look at Judges chapter 3. And I want to turn to verse 8, verse 7 of Judges 3. So the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord. They forgot the Lord their God, and they served the Baals and the Asherahs. So here they are, you know, just sort of going along, doing their own thing. But notice verse 8. Then the anger of the Lord was hot against Israel, and he sold them into the hand of this king. I could never hope to pronounce his name. And the children of Israel served this king for 8 years. 8 years. Now think about it. This is 8 years Israel's under the thumb, I guess you could say, of this king of Mesopotamia. Now the children of Israel, they cried out to the Lord, and the Lord raised up a deliverer from the children of Israel, who delivered them. His name was Othniel. He was the son of Kenaz. Well, what do you know here? Caleb's younger brother. So is it Morgan? But anyway, Caleb's younger brother. When I saw Caleb sitting out there, I thought, oh, okay. The Spirit of the Lord came upon him. He judged Israel, and this king of Mesopotamia was put down. Notice. Verse 11, the land had rest for 40 years. So 40 years, Israel had peace. Now remember, they were under the king boot for 8 years. Then they had 40 years of peace. But what happened during that 40 years of peace? The children of Israel, verse 12, again did evil in the sight of the Lord. So the Lord strengthened Eglon, king of Moab, against Israel, because they had done evil. And look at verse 14. So the children of Israel served Eglon, king of Moab, 18 years. 18 years. Here we got another situation. But God raised up a deliverer again. So we had this king of Mesopotamia, 8 years, then 40 years of peace. Then we have this king of Moab that Israel was basically servants to him for 18 years. Well, let's drop down to verse 30, because this king was subdued again with God, of course, projecting it. So Moab, verse 30 of chapter 3, Moab was subdued that day under the hand of Israel, and the land of Israel had rest for 80 years. Now, 80 years, that's a long time that Israel had peace. But what usually happens? Now, I remember so clearly, I don't know why this always sticks in my mind, but I remember when 9/11 happened, and I can remember people starting to come to church right after 9/11. In many cases, they didn't come very long, or they may only come a time or two. But as things just kind of drift along and peace came, it's easy to get complacent, isn't it? But chapter 4, verse 1, of Judges. Again, I'd encourage you to read the entire book of Judges. It's over and over and over this happens. And you can read about these specific kings that oppressed Israel and more detail about it. But when Ehud, who was a deliverer through God's help, of course, the children of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord. So the Lord sold them into the hand of Jabin, king of Canaan. Jabin, and verse 3, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord, for Jabin had 900 chariots of iron, and for 20 years he harshly oppressed Israel. So it seems like God is giving Israel a little bit more and more to humble them. Let's look at verse. Well, I could read on. We see about Deborah and so forth, but dropping down to the last verse in chapter 5. So Israel is protected from here, and notice the land had rest for 40 more years. Now, what happens to Israel during this time of peace? Did they get the point? Do we ever get the point? When things go bad in our life, we cry out to God. I remember so clearly someone that I knew, but they were good friends of Penny's, and the husband said he was an atheist. And the wife used to, you know, grew up in the Church of God, and so he's an atheist. But their son got sick once, and they didn't call me, because they didn't know me as well as Penny. They called Penny and asked if she and I would pray for their son. Well, if he's an atheist, if God didn't exist, what's the point of praying? I think down deep, I wonder how much, whether a person claims to be an atheist or agnostic, what's the point? Don't they really know there's got to be something? I think usually they do. But chapter 6, verse 1, the children of Israel, again, it's like a broken record. Over and over it goes. The children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord. He delivered them into the hand of Midian for 7 years. 7 years. And the Midian prevailed against them. He got one problem after another, and they cried out to God again. And once again, you know, why do you have to learn the lessons the hard way? Once again, God delivered them. And Gideon's around, and Gideon dies, and one thing after another. But here, verse 22 of Judges 8. And again, I'm not going to read too much more of Judges, but just to give us the idea of what's going on. The men of Israel said to Gideon, rule over us, both you and your son, your grandson. Also, you have delivered us from the hand of Midian. And Gideon said, I'm not going to rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall be the one to rule over you. And then verse 28, Midian was subdued before the children of Israel, so that they lifted up their heads, and the country was quiet for 40 years in the days of Gideon. Then Gideon died. Then you got the same old thing happening over and over. What's the point? What am I getting at before the lights go out? I think you could turn to the very end of the book of Judges, because I could read on and on and on for several sermons about this. What's the point? Well, I think it's pretty clear. Last verse of the book of Judges chapter 21, verse 25. In those days, there was no king in Israel. God should have been their king, should he not? Everyone did what was right in his or her own eyes. That's the way it is today in our country. Everyone seems to do whatever's right in their own eyes. So you have it. Ancient Israel forgot God. Turned back to these pagan customs and made covenants with idols. History is solid on this fact. And Satan just basically does the same thing. Now, I can go through the entire history of Israel. But Judges was a good example, I think, of the history of mankind and mankind in general. Now let's continue asking a question here. How does the devil operate? Well, he's consistent, isn't he? He's very consistent. He never changes his mode of attack. I mean, look at the Church of God over the years. How does it happen every time? Things seem to happen the same every single time. Let's look at James. Because I want us to think about how does the devil operate? James, the book of James, chapter 1. Because the devil is consistent. You know, we may go all over. You know, he's not bipolar. He's consistent. He does the same. He handles things the same way. He goes at us the same direction. And he's pretty successful because we let him be. But in verse 1 of James, now James chapter 1, you know, James, who was the brother of Jesus Christ, of course, Jesus was born of, Mary was a virgin, but then Mary had children. James was the first. And James, a servant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ, he wrote this to the 12 tribes of Israel, which were scattered abroad. And he said, my brethren. Now James says something here that it's hard for me to understand. But I think I can understand it better by what we just read in Judges. My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials. I've never gone through a trial that I look forward to. I've never gone through a trial, and we've gone through some trials that I hope some of you never have to go through. Very, very hard trials, like a death of, you know, Penny's son. I hope no one has to go through anything like that. But yet, it's not that you look forward to the trial, but if we handle it right, and it's a lifelong process sometimes, a trial can help you and help me on our journey to what we really long for, the kingdom of God. And James, who would know a lot about trials, he said, count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. So when you go through a trial, you can, and I could just let the trial completely cause you to fall apart. Or it can also can bring you or I closer to God if we let it, if we see what we're looking like. I appreciate Larry Perriman's sermonette. And, you know, think of what we go through sometimes. And, you know, when somebody, you know, there's a bunch of people that I pray about every day that I know have lost a loved one. And there's not, and, you know, there's many others that I don't mention every day, but there's people that every day, there are certain people that I know well that I'll say something every day when I pray to God. And yet, because I know what they're going through sometimes. Not completely, because no one, you know, it's like when somebody goes to a funeral. What is one of the things they say so often to the person that's in mourning? I know what you're going through. No, you don't. No, you don't. And I don't either when I tell somebody I know what you're going through. I think the easiest, most profitable thing to say is, I'm sorry. I love you. Because that's what we need to, we get all these little things that we just fuss and fight about. They're so insignificant in the whole scheme of things. My brethren, count all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing, here's the bottom line, the testing of our faith, it can produce patience. And patience, let it have its perfect work, that you may be perfect. Not perfect like Jesus Christ perfect, but mature as a Christian, lacking nothing. Then it says something that I think we all should be aware of. If any of you lacks wisdom. I know I lack wisdom at times, and we all lack wisdom at times. So what does God say to do? Ask God for wisdom, who gives liberally and without reproach, and it will be given them more wisdom. So true Christians, as James mentions here, knows that despite how hard it could be and how no one wants to go through a trial, don't think I'm saying it's good to go through it, that you want to go through a trial, but it can bring you and I closer to God. It really can. It doesn't mean we understand everything, but it gives us the opportunity. It can draw you closer to God. True Christians, if we look at the Bible tells us trials can, despite the fact that they're not enjoyable, can be for our good in the end. Now, 1 Peter chapter 6, here's the Apostle Peter saying similar thing. In 1 Peter, I don't know if I said 1 Peter chapter 6. If I did, it doesn't exist. But 1 Peter chapter 1, somehow I think I said that. I'm anticipating the blackout, I guess. 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 6 and 7 says, "In this you greatly rejoice." So what are we rejoicing on? And Peter says right here, "Though now for a little while, if need be, you've been grieved by various trials." So what is going on, he says. And what do trials do? He says it right here, that the genuineness of your faith, God will never tempt you more than you can handle. But yet, it's trials aren't fun. Trust me. I have a hard time. When I pray, it's like I don't want to say, "God, give me more patience," because I worry about what that might mean, what I might have to go through. God knows what I need. God knows what you need. God will take care of what we need. But the trials can help prove the genuineness of your faith, which is much more precious than gold, though it's tested by fire, that you may be found to praise, honor, and glory when Jesus Christ returns. That's what it's all about. So we all experience various types of trials. I'm not saying they're fun or whatever the case may be, but many of the things you and I go through in our life, we may not understand. Do you think Job understood what he was going through? No. But yet God knows. Now, if I was the devil, I would know that a trial, that a test can be good for a Christian. So if I was the devil, I would want you to think everything's just smooth sailing. Doesn't matter what you do. Relax. Look at our society, what's going on now. It's hideous, some of the stuff that's happening. It's beyond belief, some of the things that are going on. And I look at our political system, which of course is just, this isn't the way God intends things to be. It's impossible. God's not like that. But if I were the devil, I would know that a trial can really help a Christian. God gives us a warning over in Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy chapter 6. Not sure what that means, but that could be bad. That noise. Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 10, 11, and 12. Here the Israelites are about to go into the promised land. Verse 10, "And it shall be, when the Lord your God brings you into the land which he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob, to give them you large and beautiful cities which you didn't build." They didn't build these cities that God was giving to them. Houses, full of all these good things, which you didn't fill. Hewn out wells, which you didn't dig them. Vineyards and olive groves, which you didn't plant. When you have eaten and when you're full, it says, beware lest you forget the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Israel from the house of bondage. So when a person learns the truth of God, God says, don't forget it, what he's given you. God says, be careful, lest you could forget, or I could forget the prosperity. Just living in our country, how blessed are we living here? Then what if you lived in, you know, I think of so many places, North Korea, for instance, right now. Got that guy who shoots off rockets every day, thinks it's the 4th of July every day. He's just shooting rockets all over the place. What is the point of all this craziness? We're heading on a slippery slope, and we're moving down fast. Now, God gives another warning in Deuteronomy 8, among other places, verse 10 through 14. When you've eaten, when you're full, then you shall bless the Lord your God for the good land which he has given you. Beware that you do not forget the Lord your God by not keeping his commandments, his judgments, his statutes, which I command you today, lest when you've eaten and are full, and you've built beautiful houses and you dwell in them, and when your herds and your flocks multiply and your silver, your gold are multiplied and all that you have is multiplied, when your heart is lifted up, if you forget the Lord your God who brought you out of Israel from the house of bondage, it will not go well. So where am I heading here? Well, you know, I could turn to Matthew 19, where it talks about how hard it is for a rich person to enter the kingdom of God. Doesn't say they can't and they won't, doesn't say they won't, but it's so easy. When you're prosperous, when you're wealthy, when you have these things, how easy it is to forget about God. Now, I found this somewhere. I think this is interesting since tomorrow's Christmas. And, you know, I thought this was interesting because I see this commercial on television. And a lot of these commercials about, you know, what everybody wants. There's that one commercial, they're out in the snow, and this one man's giving his wife, I think, a dog for Christmas, and then this giant, massive car comes rolling in. The other one's going to give a car. Hey, I bet there's nobody in here that has the money to give somebody a car for the Feast of Tabernacles. Maybe there is, but not too many. But I jotted down here in 1913, what's that? Not too good at math, but about 110 years ago. What were the 6 most popular Christmas presents? Again, I'm not advocating keeping Christmas, but you know what I'm saying. What is the most popular things today? You know, you'd have to go look. The number one, just think about this. What do you think? The number one requested gift was candy. Just candy. Just because I have some candy. Second most popular item, guess I will drink the water, would be given some nuts. Nuts. But it's amazing how prosperity makes you think you need more. The third most popular item was be given a pair of mittens or gloves. The number 4 was a rocking horse. Number 5 was a toy train. And number 6 was a bag of oranges. How things have changed. You know, Christmas isn't, you know, is the truth, but notice how materialism has increased. Now, I got this thing across, it came across my phone, I jotted this down, You know how your phone, you'll come across, you get these news items come across. And sometimes I'm not really sure, you know, why I get what I get. But I got something 2 days ago that I thought was really interesting to me. And it was from this, what was it called? I think it said artnet.news something. But the title was Christmas Miracle. It had a little question mark. And I'll just read, you know, how it'll have the name, they'll have the first little line. It says, Israeli archaeologists are freshly excavating a tomb believed to hold the woman who helped deliver the baby Jesus. Never really thought about that. So they're all excited, because they have found, they think, the tomb of the woman who is the midwife who delivered the baby Jesus. Now, I got a little interested, so I think actually this morning I went in and I just read a little bit of the article, and it says the woman's name was Salome, S-A-L-O-M-E. Now, that name should strike you. Who was Salome? Well, okay, she's mentioned in the Bible. And it's not totally impossible that she was the midwife. I mean, not impossible, I guess. I guess, you know, somebody helped, but I don't think it's true. But first of all, how would they even know that's grave is that woman? And it says, okay, over in Mark, there's two women, Salome. Just something off the path a little bit, but I think it's, you might find this interesting. Now, in Mark 15:40, it's the first place Salome is mentioned. She was at the crucifixion along with Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of Jesus. You know, they were at the crucifixion. And then over at Mark 16, first few verses, again, she's present, as is Mary Magdalene. Remember when the angel appeared when Christ was resurrected? And again, all this is like, well, what's that got to do? Well, where did they come up with this? Salome was the midwife that delivered the baby Jesus. And it's found in the Gospel of James. Well, there is no Gospel of James. There's a letter of James, but this is one of these apocryphal gospels that, you know, pass around out there. And in that Gospel of James, it says that it goes through all this stuff about how she was the midwife, delivered the baby Jesus. Now, I also read, and I don't know if this is correct or not. It could be. It's not that big a deal if it is or isn't. But this Salome that was at the crucifixion and at the resurrection, they say, again, I don't know, that she was the wife of Zebedee. Now, who was Zebedee? Well, Zebedee was the father of the apostles James and John, so she would have been the mother of the apostles. Or remember what happened when the mother of James and John went to Jesus and asked if her two sons could sit at Jesus Christ's right hand, and Jesus said, that's not mine to give. So it just keeps getting deeper and deeper. But there was another Salome that's not mentioned in the Bible, and it may not even be the right name. But Josephus, who's he's written the historical book. So Josephus talks about another Salome. So you got this one Salome that supposedly delivered the baby Jesus. Again, I'm way off track here, but it's just something to make you think how things, this is all from the Christmas miracle of some tomb they supposedly found that supposedly has this woman. How would you even know? You know, the Emperor Constantine, he supposedly discovered the tomb where Jesus was buried, didn't he? Built a church there, but I'm sure that was not where Jesus was buried. But, you know, this is what Satan wants you to get all twisted around and interested in stuff that do not matter at all. But who is this other Salome that Josephus talks about? It's not in the Bible, but Josephus talks about it. And we can turn, again, I'm trying to show us how the devil, he wants you to get up on all these little twigs and things that really don't amount to much of nothing. Mark chapter 6. This is who Josephus says was Salome, a second Salome, not the one that was at the tomb. Mark 6, I think you'll remember this time. It's fairly interesting. It's dealing with John the Baptist. Verse 14 of Mark 6. Now Herod heard of him, of John the Baptist, and his name had become well known. And he said, he heard of Jesus. And he said, well, John the Baptist must have been risen from the dead. And therefore these powers are work of him. Others said, no, it's Elijah, and blah, blah, blah. And verse 16, but Herod heard, he said, this is John who I beheaded. He's been raised from the dead. And Herod himself had sent and laid hold of John, and he bound him in prison for the sake of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, whom he had married. Verse 20. Herod feared John, knowing that he was a just and holy man. He protected him. And when he heard him, he did many things. He listened to him gladly. But at an opportune day came Herod on his birthday. He gave a feast for his nobles and the high officers and the chief men of Galilee. And when Herodias' daughter herself came in and danced and pleased Herod and those who sat with him, the king said to the girl, whatever you want, I'll give you. And the mother told the daughter, ask for the head of John the Baptist. And Josephus says the daughter's name was Salome. Again, it may be, maybe not. Now, Josephus could very well be. So here you've got this thing that just came across my phone, that they've discovered the grave of Salome, who was the one who delivered the baby Jesus. We don't. I feel fairly confident that's not correct. But then you've got this Salome that Josephus said is the one that danced for Herod and asked for John the Baptist. I mean, all this stuff. Satan wants us to get off on all these little twigs. And quite frankly, you can't prove a lot of these things. Sort of interesting, I guess, to, you know, from a historical point of view. But just like today, we look back at over 100 years ago when people were so thrilled to get some candy for a gift, or some nuts, or some oranges, or a pair of gloves, which we just take for granted because we are so prosperous. We have so much in our country that we have, as a country, basically have forgotten about God. God is so unimportant to mankind in so many ways. Material wealth is not wrong, but how do we handle it? Luke 21. So what am I talking about here? Satan wants you to just drift along. He wants me to just drift along. We have been blessed to live in a country that has so much. We have a $33 trillion debt, and yet we don't really, you can't get out of a debt that big. We have a $1.7 trillion budget. None of this stuff. Can you imagine if you had a credit card debt of, you know, whatever your limit is, they take your credit card away from you. I remember Caleb Green's father. I just thought of this, Wiley Green. He's a chiropractor. And he told me one time, there was a member, a lady, it happened to be one of his patients, and he was talking to her, and the debt, and this was several years ago, the United States debt was, I don't know, on paper, something like $25 trillion. I think it's even less than that. It's going up so quick. And he was talking to this patient, and she said, why don't we just make a coin that's worth $25 trillion and just pay off our debt with that? How does that work? That doesn't even make any sense. Now, you might, what's that guy's name? Who's the guy with FTX, Jackman, or whatever his name is? He tried it, didn't he? He was riding high there for a while. Now he's out on bail, and he can't leave his parents' house until he goes to trial, and he'll wind up in jail. Satan wants us to just drift along, doesn't he? There is no such thing as a coin that can pay off our debt. There's no such thing as anything that can pay off our debt to God except the sacrifice of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. And yet, mankind just does not appreciate it. And I look at myself and I ask myself sometimes, how much do I appreciate what I have? Luke 21, the words of Jesus Christ, if you have a red letter Bible, verse 34, Luke 21, but take heed to yourselves, lest your hearts be weighted down with carousing, drunkenness, and the cares of this life, just all the things that are going on, that that day may come upon you unexpectedly. What day? The return of Jesus Christ. That we're not ready for it. For it will come as a snare on all those who dwell on the face of the earth. Watch therefore and pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things that are going to come to pass. The evil that's all around us. And to be able to stand before the Son of Man. He was in the daytime teaching in the temple, but at night he went out and he stayed on the mountain called Olivet. And early in the morning, all the people would come to him to hear him. Jesus Christ. He's saying, don't let the cares of this world turn you or turn me away from what's really important. What's really important. Now, we all have our likes, our dislikes. That's not wrong. But how much are we getting infected by what's going on in this world, which is just not, it's not right. You know that, and I know that. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. We're coming into the home stretch here. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. Apostle Paul, this was probably the second letter he wrote of the letters. Not certain, but probably. Verse 6, 7, and 8 of 1 Thessalonians 5. Therefore, let us not sleep as others do, but let us watch and be sober. It's sobering times. For those who sleep, sleep at night, and those who get drunk at night. But let those of us or of the day, let us be sober, putting on the breastplate of faith and love, and as helmet, the hope of salvation. That is our hope, salvation. Return of Jesus Christ and to be in the kingdom of God. Going over a couple books to 1 Timothy. 1 Timothy chapter 6. When it's all said and done, it makes no difference whatsoever if they've discovered a grave, for instance, that has this Siloam regardless of who she is. Now, it's interesting, I guess, you know, intellectually, I guess it's sort of fun to see and look at things, but in the whole scheme of things, it's not really that important. It's not really that important if the Salome is the daughter of Herodias who danced for Herod when John the Baptist was beheaded. It really doesn't make a lot of difference, although it's kind of fun to read about it and think about it, but is that what it's all about? You know, I've got a friend that I've known for years, I worked with in healthcare for years, and when we moved back to Athens, he asked me if I would work with him some, and he's materials manager for two hospitals in Decatur, Huntsville area. So I'm working with him some, and right now I'm working 5 days a week, but I'm not going to be doing that long, but I'm just to help out. And I have to go in at like around 6 in the morning. I work from like 6:30 to noon. And I'm actually kind of enjoying it, although I won't be doing it full time. But when I had to go yesterday morning, because the department, the materials at the place I was the only person there, so I knew I needed to get there, and I was wondering what the weather would be like, and it was really cold, very cold. The wind chill was way below zero, and I got there just fine, and when I went in, the wound care department of the hospital, the pipes had broke. And it flooded. And they're all in there trying to clean it up. And there were these ladies from housekeeping that I see certain ones every day when I'm there. And, you know, they don't make much money. They don't make much money. In fact, I heard they got a raise. And I know what their raise was to. And I figured it out. I don't know how people live on that. But they're there every day. I see them every day, and they're out there, and one was telling me, yeah, they came in at 4:30, and everything was flooded, and we're trying to get the hospital all cleaned up. Well, these aren't wealthy people, and these are people that, you know, I don't even know if they're religious or not, but they're people, they're human beings, and they got a raise. And everyone that worked for that hospital group that was making under $14 an hour got a raise to $14 an hour. And I took my calculator and I multiplied 14 times 40 times 52, and that's less than $30,000 a year working 8 hours a day. Now, do we appreciate how fortunate we are? You can make more money by sitting at home and from the government giving you stuff than if you're out there trying to be a productive member of society. But I admire people like that are out there working and trying to do the best they can. But yet, we're human beings. And Satan wants us to just feel like we don't have enough. It's like that commercial, oh man, I got to have a new car. Well, not wrong to get a new car, but is that what it's all about? Is that what the most important thing is? I don't think so. 1 Timothy 6, verse 9 and 10. But those who desire to be rich would all like a little more money. Nothing wrong with that. But if we desire to be rich, if that's all there is to life, then lie and cheat and do whatever we have to do to get more from somebody else. Those who desire to be rich fall into all kind of temptation and a snare, and in many foolish and harmful lusts, which drown men and women in destruction and perdition. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. Again, it's not wrong if you're rich, which none of us are rich materially. It's not wrong to be rich, but you have an added responsibility. And being in the church and knowing the truth of God, you and I have an added responsibility. Look at this. The love of money is the root of all kinds of evil, for which some, because they want money so badly, have strayed from the faith in their greediness and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. But you, O man of God, as Paul is speaking to Timothy, flee these things. What does Paul tell Timothy to look toward? Pursue righteousness, godliness, faith, love, patience, gentleness. Fight the good fight of faith. Hold on to eternal life. So money's power, materially, but it must be controlled. Blessings must be controlled. Without self-control and restraint, do you not think Satan wants to encourage you and me to think certain things are so important that really aren't that important? Let's look at a couple other scriptures before we close. Matthew 6. Matthew 6. And the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus Christ says in verse 21, as we have it, where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. What do you and I treasure the most? Verse 24, no one can serve two masters, for either he'll hate the one and love the other, or else he'll be loyal to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. In other words, it's great when we're blessed, but if it takes you or I away from God, it's not good. The devil knows. If he can hook you on materialism, pleasures of this world, the soft life, I guess you could say, that you think you cannot, that I think I cannot live without, then your my mind can be turned away from godliness. The Bible clearly reveals that the mind set on the flesh and all the physical things that we think we have to have, it's against God's way. Again, be thankful. I should be thankful for all the blessings we have. I'm very thankful where I live now. Penny and I were talking just last night, I think, of the places we've lived, I think we've moved 8 times in the last 12 or 13 years. And I think where we live now is my favorite place we've lived. I really like it down there. But yet, that's not going to be the answer to everything. The devil wants you, the devil wants me to think, to misuse prosperity, so that it can become a curse, not a blessing. He wants to get people to set their heart on material things and forget about God. It's as simple as that. So if I were the devil, in conclusion here, what would I do? I think we've looked at it today. With my power, I'd give you and I'd give me a smooth sailing physically. I'd hold back some persecution. You don't really need that because that could turn you to God. I'd assure you, I'd convince you, there's no need to pray harder or even pray at all. There's no need to study. There's no need to sacrifice. Everything's going to be all right. Take it easy. Have another nut or an orange. I'd say relax, enjoy yourself. You got it made. I'd convince you there's no decay around your spiritual armor like you see in Ephesians 6 that we won't turn to. But if our armor is down, it'd be very easy, or easier, I guess you could say, for you to ignore this final scripture that we're going to be turning to in 1 Peter chapter 5. 1 Peter chapter 5. If our armor is down, if I think I got to have the good life, Apostle Peter, who sure wound up going through some trials. Verse 6 of 1 Peter 5. Therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that he, God, may exalt you in due time, at the proper time, at the return of Jesus Christ. Cast all your cares upon him, for he, God, cares for you. Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, who never varies in his approach, remember that, he's always going to come at you the same way. He walks around like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Satan wants to devour me. He wants to devour you. He wants to devour all mankind. That's what I would do to deceive you if I were the devil. Well, it's been great to be here. The lights can go out now. The snakes can fall out of the ceiling, man. That was a scary day. No. Oh, I will say this, and this is off the subject, off the sermon, but the day that happened years ago, we had two new people showed up. They never came back.